You're listening to TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio.
TalkZone.com.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Jones wide to the left side. Slot set up to the right side. Rodgers shotgun with a step back to his left end, Brendan Jackson. Snap to Aaron Rodgers. Rushes on. Four-man rush. Screens it out left side. Jackson.
Good.
Picks up a couple of blocks.
Good.
Jackson to the 10, to the 5, to the end zone. Touchdown! What an answer!
Have you under center. Obamano goes in motion right to left. Turn and handle into left side. Finds a little bit of a hole. Keeps his right moving. He's across the 40. Midfield. 45. He's on the run with. 40. Pushes him at 35. Look at him go. He's down to 20. 15. He could go. He is going to go. Touchdown, Seahawks. A 67-yard run. Marshawn Lynch. Unbelievable.
This is Wayne Larrabee with senior editor Eric Edholm filling in for the publisher and editor Pro Football Weekly Hub Arkish this week and the Pro Football Weekly staff. Coming up, our divisional playoff edition of Pro Football Weekly.
We'll break down the Pro Football Weekly major awards from this season and take a spin around the coaching carousel.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Along with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish, this is Wayne Larrabee, and we welcome you to Pro Football Weekly Divisional Playoff Edition. Hub is on assignment, so filling in with us on the show today is senior editor Eric Edholm. And Eric, great to have you with us. As always, we get snippets of your reporting throughout the course of the season and during these shows, but it's great to have you for the whole content.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, let's start with one of your teams, the Philadelphia Eagles. You know, I left Philadelphia last Sunday evening, and the talk was already beginning. You know, what's going to happen with Michael Vick, who's a free agent? It's obvious they want to keep him. But Andy Reid on Monday came out and said, hey, I want both quarterbacks. I want Kevin Cobb as well. However, Kevin Cobb in the locker room after the game was saying that he wants to be traded if he's not the starting quarterback. Where do you think they go here?
Well, they're going to have to sit tight, Wayne, until this whole collective bargaining agreement is worked out. I mean, until they figure out, you know, no players can be traded. You know, they're certainly not going to go ahead and sign Vick to a long-term deal in the interim. So, this is going to be, you know, Philly fans are going to have to wait a couple of months on this one, it looks like, as everything points towards that deadline passing without a new CBA being agreed upon. But the interesting option is here is if there is a franchise tag in the new CBA, most people close to the organization feel it's a wise move to go ahead and tag Vic, you know, and that would pay him $17 or $18 million next year. But sources close to Vic have started to indicate that maybe he wouldn't be thrilled with that kind of option, that he feels like his window to get a long-term deal is smaller. He's going to be 31. Certainly he took a beating this season. You know, the offensive line didn't always protect him well. He runs a lot, so he exposed himself, won't slide, so he's going to take a lot of big hits. So the option right now would be to franchise him with the hopes of working out a long-term deal. But then you've got Cobb, and you've got to figure out whether you should trade him, get a couple first-round picks, or keep him as your backup as a good insurance policy.
All right, now let me ask you about Cobb and the price tag you mentioned. Is he a first-round draft choice from somebody? You know, Andy Reid going into the season talked up, going into the opener, said, hey, Kevin Cobb is our guy. We're ready for this. He's ready, et cetera. He's been lying in wait for a couple of years now. Is he ready to be a bona fide starting quarterback in this league? Because he has the endorsement from someone really respected around the league as a guy who knows quarterbacks and Andy Reid. But if you look at the on-field production outside of a two-game stint in the 2009 season at the end of the year, there's not much to pick from.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about the performance this year. It wasn't there. No, granted, he had one healthy half of football before he got knocked out in the first game against Green Bay, came back, and, you know, it's a tough situation. Obviously, he got some time in the middle of the year when Vic was hurt, and then in Week 17 when the Eagles rested a lot of their starters. So, you know, you've got this quarterback who looks to be a little bit of damaged goods, not as good as Vic. I think they'll set the price tag very high, and I'm thinking two first-round picks, just to see, will teams bite at that? Because I don't think they necessarily want to trade him, but if somebody blows them away with an offer, they might pull the trigger.
Meanwhile, Washington Redskins owner Daniel Snyder, another non-playoff season for the Redskins. He's had this team for over a decade now, and he's had a lot of ups and downs, mostly downs. And, you know, he was asked, Eric, his biggest free agent gaffe, and Daniel Snyder always jumps out on the first day of free agency, gets someone, usually the biggest name. Albert Haynesworth wasn't only the biggest name, he was the biggest body out there a couple of years ago, and it just didn't work out. Is that his biggest gaffe?
Yeah, he wouldn't admit to it, but he referred to, you know, I don't need to answer this. So obviously he was sort of saying that, look, we made a mistake. And this is, he kept talking about it being the people's team. Yeah, sure, it's the Redskins' money, but, you know, they're charging some outrageous ticket prices. They have a backlog on season tickets. They sell out every game. And he realizes that the people make this happen. So he kind of came forth with a little bit more candor than he normally does. He's done more interviews in the last year or two, talking about how he's matured as an owner from age 34 when he bought the team to 46 now. So maybe a different side of Snyder. The interesting question Redskins fans will ask is the different Snyder coming out in terms of football stuff? Will they be more reserved in free agency? Will they retain their draft picks? I think the presence of Mike Shanahan, long-term vision-wise, I think they're going in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. He certainly showed a lot of humility in that interview, which is not his style normally. Now, as far as Haynesworth goes, all right, let's say he's out there. Does he maybe try to hook up with Jim Schwartz, his former defensive coordinator at Tennessee, now the head coach at Detroit, and is Jim Schwartz interested?
Well, he might be interested, but you look at that Lions defensive line, Wayne, and they're so good. They've got Corey Williams playing next to Ndamukong Suh, who had Pro Football Weekly's Rookie of the Year. You know, I think that's a great situation there. They've got Kyle Vandenbosch coming off injury. He's a big leader for that team. I don't know if Haynesworth is the right chemistry mix. They're building something kind of special in Detroit. And even though the connection with Schwartz and Haynesworth is there, even though the Lions could get him cheap, Martin Mayhew's done a great job of building that roster. I've been hearing that they're a little suspicious of this whole thing and that they might stay away unless the price is super, super low.
Now, I got to tell you, Eric, that defensive line as presently constituted in Detroit is one of the best in pro football,
yes,
not just the NFC. Senior editor Mike Wilkening joins us. And, Mike, down in Houston, there's a new sheriff of the defense in town. Wade Phillips brings his 3-4 look to the Houston Texans. And what will this mean, especially for the great Mario Williams, the defensive end?
Well, it means that they're going to try to emphasize his strengths, which is rushing the passer. 48 sacks in 5 years. He's been their best pass rusher basically for these last 4 years and one of the best in the AFC. I was a little bit banged up towards the end of last year, missed some time for the first time in his career, but this is an incredibly durable, strong, athletic end who probably can fit in any scheme and is now going to get a chance to play in Wade Phillips' 3-4 scheme. The idea is that they're going to let him rush the passer. It's going to be a given, I think, that he's going to be a productive player. The question is, how do the other pieces work in this scheme? They're still trying to figure all that out, but they look like they've got some building blocks. You've got Brian Cushing, who would seem to have the skills to fit in any scheme. D'Amico Ryans as well. Whether Cushing is inside or outside really remains to be seen. Ryans probably an inside guy in this scheme, but they've got some front seven building blocks. I think it starts with Mario Williams, though, and if anybody can sort of bring out the best in him in a 3-4, I think it would be Wade Phillips.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. Appreciate it. We will talk to you again next week. We'll be back with more Way We Hear It when this postseason edition of Pro Football Weekly continues. Listening to Pro Football Weekly, divisional playoff weekend in the NFL, and we continue with the Way We Hear It. Hub is on assignment this week. Joining us in studio is senior editor Eric Edholm, and we're joined also by associate editor Dan Parr. Dan, one of your teams, the Carolina Panthers, had some news this week. They hired San Diego defensive coordinator Ron Rivera. Tell us about it.
Yes, Wayne, Rivera is the new head coach in Carolina, and his first priority is now trying to fix an offense that picks up the 32nd ranked offense in the league, and they're going to have to make a decision at quarterback. There's some issues at running back they're going to have to address. D'Angelo Williams will be a free agent. So that is his main priority, and he's been interviewing offensive coordinator candidates this week.
And now when you look at that situation, you obviously mentioned the offense. I mean, the Carolina Panthers lost 14 games this season, and yet probably their biggest loss this year was losing Andrew Luck when he decided to return to Stanford. Is there a possibility of them drafting a quarterback with that number one pick, or is it more likely because they hired Rivera, because they seem to be putting more of an emphasis on defense, that we could see a defensive player in that spot?
Well, I think that decision will have a lot to do probably with what Rivera ends up deciding on about Clausen. If he feels like this is a guy who can be their franchise quarterback, and he didn't rule out coming to that conclusion at his introductory press conference, then perhaps they'll go in a defensive direction. But if they do feel like quarterback is that pressing of a need, you know, we know that there's not really a consensus number one quarterback that is worth using the first pick on right now. But if they feel like it's that big of a need, I wouldn't rule it out at this point.
Now, I think a lot of it, if we dovetail back to the offense coordinator, who are you hearing that they're considering? Have any names surfaced as far as offense coordinator in Carolina goes under Ron Rivera?
Yes, Wayne, it sounds like Rivera's first choice is Rob Jedzinski, also from the San Diego staff. He's received permission to interview him. That could be the guy that ends up there. There have been other names thrown out. Mark Trestman, experience as an offensive coordinator in the NFL. Ron Turner, a guy that Ron Rivera worked with in Chicago. They'd know each other very well. But it looks like for now, Jedzinski is the front runner.
How about the New Orleans Saints? Reggie Bush is scheduled for a big pay hike. He probably doesn't play the kind of role that would merit that kind of pay increase. What will he do to remain a Saint? Will he take a pay cut?
It sounds like he's open to doing it, Wayne. Now, you know, we'll have to see. Bush kind of said that there's going to be a line that he's going to have to draw somewhere. He's not going to play. He said he's not dumb. He's not stupid. He's not going to be willing to play for nothing. He's going to want a certain amount of money, and whether the Saints and him can come to an agreement, that will decide his fate in terms of whether he's back in 2011. But they're certainly not going to pay him $11.8 million, which is what he's due to make under his current deal.
Well, Dan, obviously that running back position was probably the Achilles heel of the Saints this year. You know, if you were to ask the one big difference between when they won the title and this season, losing to the Seahawks in a shocker last weekend, you would say that the running back position was the most vulnerable. And not only does Bush play there, but Pierre Thomas plays there. He and head coach Sean Payton knocked heads a little bit. Pierre had the knee injury. What are his chances of coming back and playing the same role he did last season?
Well, he's probably not going to have as much interest as maybe people thought he would once he hits the open market after an injury-plagued season. He ended the season on IR, wasn't able to play in the postseason game. We do hear that whatever went down between him and Sean Payton earlier this season isn't really maybe have been overblown a little bit, overhyped. That's not an issue that's probably going to keep him from returning. They're able to mend fences and get along. But whether he's back, you know, we'll see. I don't think the Saints are willing to really invest a lot of money into that position. That's just not one of their beliefs in terms of, you know, the salary cap situation, what way it's going to be. They think they're going to have bigger needs elsewhere than at running back. They like Chris Ivory coming back, although he is coming off foot surgery. So there's certainly some issues that they're going to have to take care of at running back. But whether Pierre Thomas is back or not really depends on what other deals he gets and if the Saints are willing to match the price.
Associate Editor Dan Parr, thank you very much. Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane is with us as well. Dolphins owner Stephen Ross, a well-documented courtship of Jim Harbaugh to become the head coach of the Miami Dolphins. Meanwhile, he still had a head coach in Tony Sperano hanging in the wind. So once Harbaugh spurned the Dolphins, what happened then? Ross goes back, gives Sperano a two-year extension, and is that making everything good down there, Kevin?
Oh, well, it was a pretty bizarre week, Wayne, and he almost gave that extension as an apology that, you know, he's almost like caught cheating on Sperano by going after Jim Harbaugh. And the three of them, and the third one being general manager Jeff Ireland, the three of them met for a long time last Friday to go over some things, and the idea is Sperano might have a little more say in personnel, and you know, this will be their year without Bill Parcells there. So you would think that the extension should mend things between Ross, Sperano, and Ireland, but another bad season for the Dolphins next year under Sperano, and Ross will just he'll just end up losing more money if he decides to go another direction after 2011.
Hey, Kevin, in the last, and we have about 20 seconds or so, Jeff Ireland hasn't been, you know, called out enough, I don't think, for his draft picks. Is there more pressure on him to have a very productive draft this year to get this team back into contention?
Oh, absolutely. And I totally agree that he hasn't got enough flack for some of the things going on there. And again, this is his draft without Parcells, and they really need to make some changes on offense, whether at running back, at quarterback. They're going to be in the offensive line as well. So there'll be a lot of pressure on Ireland in April's draft to fix that offense.
Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane, thank you very much. Coming up, our awards segment when Pro Football Weekly resumes. Divisional playoff weekend in the NFL, and we continue on Pro Football Weekly with senior editor Eric Edholm filling in for the publisher and editor, Hub Arkush, this week. Eric, it's awards time around the NFL, and, you know, when you look at the Pro Football Weekly, Pro Football Writers of America Awards this year, let's start with the major awards in this particular segment here with the most valuable player. The 2010 most valuable player, New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady won the balloting. Hard to argue here.
Yeah, shocking, isn't it? Right? I think people started to sort of see the division between Tom Brady and the rest of the group, you know, Michael Vick and Matt Ryan and people like that, who all had fantastic seasons, no question about it. But Brady separated himself because of the efficiency they had on offense. It was incredible. Some people even thought he was better this year than he was in 2007 when he had the 50 TD passes. The reason, keeping the turnovers to a minimum, fumbles, interceptions, you almost never heard from him. You know, he had the interceptionless streak, the all-time leading streak there. Pretty impressive what they've done. 14-2 record. Not much of an argument there.
The defensive MVP, Green Bay Packers outside linebacker Clay Matthews, who had 13.5 sacks, ranking fourth in the NFL. He had a leg injury. He battled through some leg injuries in the mid-portion of the season, Eric, after a very quick start. But as he came down the stretch, even if he didn't get a sack, he influenced offensive line movement, especially before the snap, and drawing a number of procedural calls against the offense for his presence on the defensive front.
And Wayne, you know firsthand, obviously, that the rest of the defense suffered so many injuries this year. The entire team did. You know, for him to come back and be that influence player where, you know, even if offense is set out to account for him on every play and block him every play, he's still making his impact felt, not just with the sacks, but with the false starts created, the pressures, getting quarterbacks to throw off their back foot, weird arm angles, stuff like that. He's going to be such a key for the Packers in their playoff run.
2010 Coach of the Year. Well, when your team goes 14-2 and you make some of the changes the Patriots made during the season on the fly, well, Bill Belichick, you can't argue with that. He is our Coach of the Year.
I have a friend who's a 20-year season ticket holder, and he told me when the Randy Moss trade went down, he said, people are starting to doubt Bill. You never doubt Bill Belichick. Come on. I mean, this guy knows his team. He understands the tenor of his team better than probably any other coach in the league. Great executive, but probably even a better teacher. And when he had that young defense this year and was able to put some pieces together on offense, Danny Woodhead, you know, Ben Jarvis, Green Ellis, switching up the offensive line a little bit, Logan Mankins for a couple weeks. It's so impressive to see how efficient they were on both sides of the ball. Maybe not great defensive rankings, but the overall performance, outstanding.
Detroit Lions rookie defensive tackle Ndamukong Suh, the 2010 Rookie of the Year. Eric, we've seen a lot of guys burst on the scene and make a big splash. I don't think anyone had more impact on a defense at this stage in his career than this young man.
10 sacks, but beyond that, it's the same thing. It's the enthusiasm he brought. You know, we talked about the leadership of Kyle Vandenbosch that he added to the Lions defense, but just the enthusiasm, the raw. You know, again, some of these turned into penalties against Sue and against the Lions, but they'll take that. They don't want to temper him in any way. Far better pass rusher than I thought he would be right away, and a great run defender as well. You look at that young defense all of a sudden, Wayne, they're looking pretty good, and he's the centerpiece.
Well, you know, the Comeback Player of the Year award can be directly tied to the Defensive Player of the Year award, because if Clay Matthews doesn't knock Kevin Cobb out of the opener in Philadelphia, Michael Vick may not get his chance to become the Comeback Player of the Year. What a great season he had leading the Philadelphia Eagles to the playoffs.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you can define comeback in any way you want. I mean, obviously, Vick, a lot of this was self-inflicted. You can look at guys like E.J. Henderson coming off two straight major injuries, Mike Williams, the incredible comeback in Seattle. But for Vick, playing the quarterback position, getting, you know, not being the starter for most of the training camp, getting thrown in there week one and having the season he did, even if he tailed off a little at the end, amazing performance he turned in this year.
As far as Executive of the Year goes, well, you know, Thomas Dimitroff might have been a good choice down in Atlanta, but our Executive of the Year is Scott Pioli in Kansas City. In a couple of short seasons, Eric, he has done a sensational job. The Chiefs are division champs in the AFC West and a playoff entrant this year.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the number of needs they've had this year, and the laundry list was incredible, but he had a productive draft, 6-7 guys producing as rookies. You know, they got Matt Castle last year, and obviously he took a huge step with Charlie Weiss coming on. You know, they had holes at nose tackle and a pass rusher opposite Tom Bahali, right tackle. So many spots, and yet they still won the division, turned in a great year. Pioli had a lot to do with it.
2010 Assistant Coach of the Year, Marty Morningweg of the Philadelphia Eagles. I'll tell you what, I'll take exception to this one award here from where I sit. Dom Capers, the defensive coordinator of the Green Bay Packers, did a phenomenal job with all the injuries they had in Green Bay. But at any rate, Morningweg is the choice by the writers.
So many good candidates, like you mentioned. Capers, Charlie Weiss, what he did with the Chiefs we just mentioned. Dick LeBeau, he could win this award every year probably. But Marty, I think the fact that he changed Michael Vick when many said it couldn't be done. He got him to look at his short stuff, to dump off, to stay in the pocket, to use his feet to his advantage, not just running, but to clear ways to make plays through the passing game. They had great weapons. It was supposed to be a rebuilding year. Vick was not even part of the plan, so Marty did a pretty good job reshaping that offense.
Stay tuned. Our divisional playoff weekend edition of Pro Football Weekly continues after these messages.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Along with senior editor Eric Edholm, who's filling in for the publisher and editor Hub Arkish this week, I'm Wayne Larrabee. It's interesting to note about the divisional round of the postseason. In the AFC, it's about divisional rubber matches. In the NFC, it's about regular season rematches. The Saturday divisional playoff games in the NFL this weekend, for the third time this season, the Baltimore Ravens and Pittsburgh Steelers, two bitter rivals in the AFC North, collide. This time in Pittsburgh. Craig Heist has the story.
Well, nothing really needs to be said. It's Ravens-Steelers round three, and this time there's a trip to the AFC Championship game on the line. Both teams finished with 12-4 records, but the Steelers won the AFC North by virtue of a better division record. This year, the regular season meetings were decided by 3 points. The Steelers beat the Ravens back in Week 13 in Baltimore, but the Ravens downed the Steelers in Week 4 at Heinz Field. So they know they can do it, but as linebacker Terrell Suggs knows,
this is a whole new game. A lot more is on the line now than it was in Week 4. And both teams are different teams than they were in Week 4, and then both teams are better. So, you know, they didn't have Big Ben. We didn't have Ed Reed. But now everybody's, you know, healthy for this game.
In both of those games, Ravens quarterback Joe Flacco was in the center of everything. His touchdown pass in the final minute to T.J. Houzmandzadeh won the game in Pittsburgh. In Baltimore, Flacco was sacked late in the game by Troy Polamalu, causing a fumble, which led to a Ben Roethlisberger touchdown pass to win the game. So Flacco knows he has to be aware of where Polamalu is at all times.
He's so good at, you know, reacting to certain things and playing tendencies and taking chances on things because he knows that the upfront guys are going to get some sort of pressure. So you have to take away, you have to play sound football so you can take away his chances of making plays, because if you give him enough chances to make a lot of, you know, big play, more times than not, he's going to make it.
So just how close is this rivalry? In 17 meetings since 2003, the teams have each scored 302 points. In the two games this year, each team scored 27 points. Five of the seven meetings over the last 28 months have been decided by 3 points, one by four and the other by nine. But here may be the biggest stat. In the four games Ben Roethlisberger has missed in this series, the Steelers are 0-4. Otherwise, Big Ben is 8-2, and he's won six straight, while throwing 10 touchdown passes in the process. Look for another knockdown, drag-out war in Pittsburgh on Saturday. Craig Heist for Pro Football Weekly.
You know, Wayne, these games are so emotional between these two teams, and you have to wonder where the Ravens are right now with their heads. I mean, Ed Reed, tragic situation this week. His brother's missing. He spent time with his family. And then on the other half, you've got Terrell Suggs, who's been mouthing off and talking to the Steelers and really been up front. So there's this weird mix of tragedy and jubilation. So I'm curious to see where the team is emotionally.
I'll tell you one thing about these AFC playoffs now, the divisional playoffs. These teams know each other like the back of their hand. Meanwhile, the Green Bay Packers rematch with the Atlanta Falcons in primetime divisional playoff action Saturday night, and we get the preview from Gary McKillips.
The Green Bay Packers gave the Atlanta Falcons all they could handle in Week 12 of the NFL season. It took a field goal by Matt Bryant as time expired for the Falcons to defeat the Pack 20-17 at the Georgia Dome. Now the two teams return to the Dome this Saturday as the Falcons and the Packers meet in the NFC Divisional Playoffs. The Pack comes off an impressive 21-16 win over the Philadelphia Eagles in an NFC wildcard game. Quarterback Aaron Rodgers led Green Bay with 3 touchdown passes and 180 yards through the air. Running back James Starks also had an exceptional afternoon, going for 123 yards. But it may well be the Packers' defense that'll be the key going forward. Anchored by corner Charles Woodson and linebacker Clay Matthews, the Packer defense is ranked 5th in the league in the regular season, giving up just 309 yards per game and only 194 against the pass. But according to Rodgers, it won't be easy playing in Atlanta and against Falcon quarterback Matt Ryan.
You know, it's a tough place to play. Matt has been excellent playing there and won a ton of games. He's only lost twice in his time there. It's a tough environment, very loud. They're a very good team, very well coached on both sides of the ball.
Ryan matched Rodgers in regular season touchdowns with 28, but the Falcons also have one of the league's top rushers in Michael Turner, who has run for 1,371 yards this season. But even at that, Falcons tight end Tony Gonzalez says we're starting from square one.
Got to keep doing what we've been doing, and it's all even. It's all 0-0 at this point. You've done enough to get to the tournament now, and you got a great seed, but we got to make sure that we take care of business.
The Falcons closed out their regular season with a 13-3 mark. Their only losses coming at the hands of Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and New Orleans. The Pack finished 10-6, but including their playoff win, are looking for four in a row. With two stellar quarterbacks, a bevy of good receivers, including the Falcons' Roddy White and the Packers' Greg Jennings, and defenders such as John Abraham for Atlanta and Matthews and Woodson for the Pack, this game could easily resemble the previous regular season matchup, a hard-hitting battle that goes right down to the wire. For Pro Football Weekly, Gary McKillips reporting.
Thank you, Gary. Coming up, a look at the Sunday divisional playoff games. You are listening to a postseason edition of Pro Football Weekly. You are listening to Pro Football Weekly on this divisional Sunday in the NFL. The Seattle Seahawks are one of four teams to hold a victory over the Chicago Bears this season. They are the first sub-500 team to win a postseason game, so they will not be intimidated as they head to Chicago for a rematch with the Bears in the divisional playoffs. Pete Carroll, the head coach of the Seahawks, talked about his club's, well, improbable advance to this stage of the playoffs.
We found some consistency here in the last couple weeks, more so than we had. Only one change has occurred, and that Columbus is playing. He's done a nice job, and the guys have played well. I'm hoping that that's part of just growing together, and it's taken us seemingly forever to see some continuity and some growth, you know, in a positive direction with the running game. We've been spotty at best, but the last 2 weeks when we needed it most, it's been there, so we'll try to take that with us to Chicago.
Seahawks defeated the Bears 23-20 on October 17th in Chicago as running backs Marshawn Lynch and Justin Forsett combined for 111 yards and two touchdowns in that game. Now, Carroll's Seahawks are heading back to Chicago where familiarity is somewhat comforting.
We feel fortunate that we've had the trip before. We kind of know where we're going. But other than that, we're going to go against a very difficult football team. And we're looking at them like a brand-new football team, starting all over again. And they've really come around in some really positive ways of running the football. Boy, they've really committed to it in the last couple months, and it's been successful for them, and they look really like a very well-balanced football team right now with a great defense, so we got our hands full.
Coach Carroll is absolutely right. The Bears are a much different team than the one he saw in October. The Bears are about to embark on a two-game losing streak to the Seahawks on October 17th at home to the Washington Redskins on the 24th. Lovie Smith now talked about the new wrinkles his club was able to add down the stretch following their bye week.
When you play someone again for the second time and you know each other fairly well, you want to, of course, add a few things, which both of us will do. But as much as anything, just try to execute a little bit better than we did the first time. We're a better team, no doubt, but they are too, no doubt. And both teams should be this time of the year. We, you know, having the bye week to be able to rest up.
Senior editor Eric Edholm joins me. And Eric, you know, when you look at these teams in the playoffs, and especially since they played during the regular season, but, you know, there's an old coaching axiom. You never stay the same. You're either getting better or you're getting worse. You're never the same. And these two teams are a little bit different than the two teams that met in Soldier Field on October 17th.
Yeah, I think you'd have a hard time arguing which team has gotten more better, to use some bad grammar there. I mean, really, it's, you know, the Bears changed their identity, went to less of that seven-step passing drop, you know, and then going to the quick passing game, getting the running game involved. And you've got Seattle. It's been such a late thing, you know. They came into that playoff game with the Saints with a ton of questions, and yet Marshawn Lynch rumbling for that big run. You know, we heard Carroll talk about the change in the offensive line with Tyler Palumbus. I'm not sure which team has improved the most over that stretch.
Yeah, you take a look at the Seahawks, six sacks over in the Bears' win. You know, that's something that I don't know if they can count on that now, because the Bears made changes in their offensive line, and they shored up things pretty well, it looks like.
Yeah, and what's interesting about those six sacks, too, Wayne, is that 4.5 of them came from defensive backs blitzing. Now, can you keep running that, you know, that same thing? You know the Bears have been working on this now for a week, and I'm sure their protection issues will be less if they can go to a quicker passing game. But, you know, still, good pressure can get to Jay Cutler, he'll make mistakes. That's what I'm most curious about.
Marshawn Lynch had a run for the ages in that ball game against New Orleans last week. Can he put together the kind of consistency running the ball down to down that the Seahawks are going to need on the road to beat the Bears? That's a huge question in this game.
Yeah, and you know, certainly he fed off the energy of the crowd. The crowd was an immense factor in the win over the Saints, and you know, the other side of the ball on offense for the Seahawks has been Matt Hasselbeck. I mean, this is four touchdown performance. Who would have expected? So important for them to get the time he needs because he's 35. He's not moving around that pocket like he used to. But when you give him time, we saw last week, he can fire it up a little bit.
No question about it. Jay Cutler, on the other hand, had a much better year under Mike March this year, has thrown multiple touchdowns in seven games this season. He's backed by a running back who's been rock solid, Matt Forte, in the second half of the season, at least 91 yards rushing in five of his last seven games. So the first game on the divisional playoff tier for Sunday, it'll be Seattle at Chicago. The Sunday afternoon headliner of this divisional weekend and the Handicapper's Corner coming up next when Pro Football Weekly continues. The Headliner is an in-depth look at the top attraction on this weekend's NFL card. The divisional weekend camper. The New York Jets head to Foxborough to take on the top seed New England Patriots. Bart Pisterna has the story.
The Jets have crossed the lines. The first one on the field with a last-second one-point wild-card win in Indianapolis that propelled them to the divisional playoffs versus AFC East champ and arch-rival New England. The second line crossed was off the field and into the turbid tundra of tastelessness. As per usual, gangrene has attempted to incite a war of the words with the Patriots. New England declined to participate. The Jets elected to escalate, with New York DB Antonio Cromartie using an end zone expletive to describe Pat's quarterback Tom Brady. Coach Rex Ryan, what say you about your player's foul flip of the lip?
That language is, you know, was a little strong for me, but he's, you know, I think what happens this time, you know, you're so, you know, you shouldn't like the opponent you're up against right now. This is the playoffs. And trust me, the feeling's mutual.
Is it now? Well, then, let's check in with the object of Cromartie's cussing, Mr. Brady.
I've been called worse. So there's a long list of people that feel that way. You know, he's a good player. I mean, Revis is a great player. You know, they got a great secondary, and you know, they're one of the best defenses we face. So what they're capable of doing over there and shut down the Colts offense like they did is pretty impressive.
Actually, it was more like containing Peyton Manning and what's left of the Colts offense, but I'm not as tactful as Mr. Brady. With Danny Woodhead cleared to play, the Pats offense looks as healthy as the one that shredded New York in Week 13. And their learn-as-you-go D seems as opportunistic as ever. Yes, the two teams split the season series, and the franchises have split the lifetime series. But it's the Patriots who won 13 of the last 17 matchups, including the postseason. It's the Patriots who aren't missing a Jenkins, a Woody, a Leonard. It's the Patriots who are seemingly entrenched in a Sunday state of mind. Coach Hoodie Belichick.
Yeah, our job's really just to get ready for the game, so that's what we're going to do.
With a 4:30 Foxborough focus, I'm Bart Pisterna for Pro Football Weekly.
All right, thanks very much, Bart. Well, when you take a look at this ball game, I mean, you know, the Jets won the first matchup real early in the season. The Patriots more recently kind of blew them out. I don't know, Eric, how you feel about this, but I do think there is something to point differential. How many points you score, how many points you give up, and what the differential is. The Patriots are off the charts good. They're number one by far in the league in that regard, and the Jets aren't bad, but they're not even close to the Patriots, and I wonder if that's the way this game's going to play out.
Yeah, point differential and turnovers. You know, turnover differential is another key factor. So you look at those two combined. The Patriots are the better team, you know, and so we'll see. I mean, Darrell Revis, I guess that would make them Revis and Butthead at a corner. I don't know what kind of a war of words he wants to get into, but those guys have to play really great games against those Patriot wide receivers, tight ends, backs, all the guys they send out in the pass formations. It's going to be a tough chore.
And we talk about how teams change as the season goes along. There's no question the Patriots changed. The first time they played the Jets, they had Randy Moss. The second time, they didn't. Into that Week 13 meeting, Tom Brady completed passes to eight receivers, five averaged 11 yards or more per catch in that game.
Lethal. I mean, just lethal. And if they get the time they want, the Jets pass rush hasn't been exceptional. You know, they're gonna get the effects that they want. Now, defensively, I'm a little worried about this Patriots group because their defensive line very thin right now. They're counting on a couple guys, Myron Pryor and Kyle Love. I mean, those guys around Wilfork, they're gonna be tested up front by that Jets offensive line.
All right, the Jets and Patriots round three closes this divisional playoff weekend in the NFL. Time now for the Handicapper's Corner, featuring race and sportsbook executive executive Chuck Esposito of the Venetian in Las Vegas. And Chuck, a lot of these games are rematches of regular season matchups, and in fact, in the AFC, there are matchups that are going into round three. How does that affect the way you guys are able to put a number on a game?
Those are great matchups, Wayne. These two teams have a lot of history. We've seen these two teams play. The betting public loves the rivalry of these guys, and we're definitely going to take that into consideration, but it's all about how these teams are playing toward the end of the season, how healthy they are, and we're going to put up a number that we hope draws good two-way action.
Chuck, of the games this weekend, would you say that Seahawks-Bears, maybe, I don't know, maybe the least exciting, but also maybe the hardest to handicap a little bit in this this circumstance?
And maybe the least exciting, but the Bears are such a public team, and I've talked about it many times. Those public teams draw so much interest and so much action from the betting public here in Vegas that they are popular. But, yeah, it is hard to handicap. The Seahawks at 7-9 weren't really that team that anybody expected to even win one game, yet to be in a position to be one game away from the NFC Championship. So it is a little bit more difficult than the other three matchups to handicap.
Another game where you wouldn't think the line would be this close, number one seed Atlanta, number six seed Green Bay. The game is in Atlanta. Packers coming in there, and the Falcons favored by just 3 points. And, in fact, I've seen it even less than that at times during the week, Chuck. Is that a little surprising? And what are you working on there? What are you trying to get the public to do there?
You know, it's not really that surprising, Wayne. I mean, we've been below three the entire time. And although Atlanta has played so well at home, Green Bay is just that vogue team right now. They come into the playoffs playing extremely good ball. They're a very popular team. And a lot of people think they're the best team in the NFC as we speak. I think just too much value at three. I'll be surprised if that number hits a field goal by kickoff on Saturday.
Chuck Esposito of the Venetian in Las Vegas. Stay tuned. Publisher's Pen is next on Pro Football Weekly. The Publisher's Pen with the publisher and editor, Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkush, and filling in for Hub this week is senior editor Eric Edholm. Eric, let's talk about the new postseason overtime rules. Now, basically, both teams must have the opportunity to possess the ball once during the extra period. Unless the team that receives the opening kickoff scores a touchdown on its initial possession, in which case it is the winner. Opportunity to possess the football occurs on kicks. If a team scores a field goal and kicks off and the receiving team muffs the kick and it's recovered by the kicking team, the game is over. Opening kickoff. How about this? Opening kickoff of overtime. The receiving team muffs the kick. Or how about this? Try an onsides kick and the kicking team recovers the ball. Well, then the receiving team had its opportunity to possess, and the game reverts to normal overtime sudden death rules.
Wayne, can you imagine a situation in the Super Bowl? We all thought Sean Payton's onside kick to start the second half was like the mother of all special teams plays. Can you imagine that happening in the first overtime game in Super Bowl history? It's never gone to OT. What would happen in that circumstance? That would be about the riskiest call a coach could ever make, and that'll be so exciting if that does happen.
It really could be, but those are the new rules in overtime. That'll do it for Pro Football Weekly this week. Special thanks to the Packers and Seahawks radio networks. Randy Myers, our producer-engineer. Pro Football Weekly originates from the studios of Syndication Networks in Chicago, Illinois. Now for Eric Edholm and the Pro Football Weekly staff, this is Wayne Larrabee. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week with our championship edition of Pro Football Weekly.